Dear Diary, it's day five, and the economy has not yet collapsed. Considering that pretty good news in light of our prediction show last Tuesday night, it's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett with a face for radio and a voice for print. And we're going to follow up on one of those subjects from that night. In the first hour of our New Year's Day night show, we talked with Galen Cook. And he said that he was going to work on getting us a photograph that we could have, that you could see for yourself at the website, of the man which many people believe is D.B. Cooper. Galen Cook, former private investigator turned lawyer in the Washington state area, has been tracking D.B. Cooper out of personal interest and just a sense of closure for this country. And in fact, he may have tripped onto something here as a result of a phone call he got or a connection that was made after his appearance on Coast to Coast back around Thanksgiving. So he fought hard for it. Didn't look like it was going to happen around Thursday. We were still thinking it'd be a week from tonight, but he pulled it off and it's on the website, coasttocoastam.com. Go look at the photograph of the man which many people believe to be D.B. Cooper. And we'll tell you the whole story about it coming up a little bit later on, including some crypto news and John J. Harper. You've heard Art Bell talking about the solar cycle that we just started and the intimidating, challenging news of this solar cycle. What is out there right now, which many meteorologists, which many forecasters believe we could be on the cusp of in this solar cycle? Perhaps we've already experienced some things and we just haven't noticed them yet. I'll tell you what I mean by that coming up in just a second. Well, after we start next hour, John J. Harper, a little crypto news to get us warmed up, to get us started tonight next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We get to Galen Cook coming up in just a minute. He's the investigator working on the D.B. Cooper case. But first, little crypto news tonight. Frozen in much the state that it died some 37,500 years ago, a Siberian baby mammoth undergoing tests in Japan could finally explain why the beasts were driven to extinction and shed light on climate change, scientists said on Friday. You can find this story linked at coasttocoastam.com. The six-month-old calf unearthed in May by a reindeer herder in northern Siberia's remote Yamalnetets Mountains is virtually intact and even has some fur, though the tail and the ear of the animal, dubbed Lubia, were apparently bitten off. Lubia's discovery is an historic event, said the vice president of the Geneva-based International Mammoth Committee. Bet you didn't even know we had one. It could tell us why this species didn't survive and shed light on the fate of human beings. The last of the ancient beasts are thought to have roamed the earth from about 4.8 million years ago to some 4,000 years ago, and researchers have debated whether their demise was due to climate change or overhunting by humans. I would go with that latter theory. I saw that documentary, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, where the prehistoric men and women used woolly mammoths for rudimentary showers and car washes. It's called the Flintstones or something. I think, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Akito Arima, head of the Science Museum in Tokyo, where Lubia is on display, said global warming may be the reason why the baby mammoth was discovered now. That somehow with the permafrost shrinking and all of the ice cap shrinking, that more and more of these skeletons, or in this case, frozen carcasses, could be revealed. And by the way, isn't baby mammoth an oxymoron? Like jumbo shrimp? Anyway. Maybe as the planet keeps melting, we'll be able to reunite the baby with its mother. There are signs that global warming is slowing but not going away. This story from London: world temperatures will cool slightly in 2008, but it will remain among the top 10 hottest years on record. That, according to British weather experts, the impact of a strong La Nina climate pattern over the Pacific will help keep temperatures down, according to the annual forecast. Phenomena such as El Nino and La Nina have a significant influence on global surface temperature, and the current strong La Nina will act to limit temperatures in 2008, said a professor. However, mean temperature is still expected to be significantly warmer than in 2000. Sharply renewed warming is likely once La Nina declines. Either way, as you've heard, a new solar cycle is on the way. And the AP reports, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration said Friday that the first sunspot of a new 11-year cycle has appeared in the sun's northern hemisphere, the first one. The frequency of sunspots rises and falls during these cycles, and the start of a new cycle indicates they are likely to begin increasing in number. Sunspots, areas of intense magnetic activity on the sun, can affect Earth by disrupting electrical grids, airline and military communications, GPS signals, and even cell phones. During periods of intense sunspot activity known as solar storms, highly charged radiation from the sun may head toward Earth. Our growing dependence on highly sophisticated space-based technologies means we are far more vulnerable to space weather today than in the past, that according to a NOAA administrator. Last April, an international panel of solar experts forecast that solar cycle 24 would start in March 2008, plus or minus 6 months. Guess what? It's here. The panel was split between those predicting a strong or a weak cycle. Looks like a strong one. We'll talk about that coming up with John J. Harper next hour. So far, the people predicting space weather have been about as accurate as the people predicting our Earth weather, but they're getting better at it. And we'll have a space weather forecast coming up right after your space sports report on Coast to Coast AM. The Ottawa Citizen is reporting the video of what appears to be an object trailing a dark spiraling plume. And that dark spiraling plume behind it plummeting toward Prince Edward Island's Northumberland Strait is the focus of intense speculation in Canada. A PEI couple, Prince Edward Island couple, captured the strange event on video December 26, but witnesses and experts alike aren't sure what they're observing. We're kind of dumbfounded, said Tony Quigley, the PEI farmer who videotaped the apparent unidentified flying object with his wife, Marie Ford Quigley. The couple was out walking late in the afternoon on the island's west end when Mr. Quigley spotted the mysterious object. I said to Marie, look, there's a plane in trouble there. It looked like smoke coming from it. The couple taped the strange scene for nearly 6 minutes. Mr. Quigley estimates the object they saw was more than 3 kilometers high and is convinced that the UFO must have crashed in the Strait or in New Brunswick. They watched the spectacle for close to 30 minutes, received phone calls from neighbors who witnessed it. They called, found out that there were no reports of any planes going down. Air Force investigated, nothing. You can find out more on this story at coasttocoastam.com. The video is being examined, but there are some stills from the video that you can see in the story that we've linked up at the website. And it's interesting to note, too, that he and his neighbors, they all saw the same thing. While it looked like a plane going down, they were told later that it was probably some sort of space junk. Some space junk. But it's not what it looked like to them. So anyway, we'll look into that and we'll see if we can get an update in the weeks ahead on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, that's neighbor, and in this story, the Ottawa Citizen, that's neighbor spelled with a U, of course, which reminds me of when I first logged onto my new MacBook just after Christmas, and it asked me what language I wanted it to be in, and I signified English, of course, and then it asked me American English or Canadian English, and I chose American English, but I've always wondered if I'd clicked Canadian English and then typed neighbor without a U, would the spell check have flagged me for not spelling it right? And in Canadian English, shouldn't they spell UFO with two U's? I mean, if they're putting U's in everything, just asking. Anyway, it looks like the invading space aliens hovering silently behind their cloaking devices just outside of Earth's atmosphere are going to eat the Canadians first after all. Or maybe they've decided to have some Cornish hens for starters. Britain is turning into an alien nation, according to Sun readers, who have flooded the paper with reports of UFO sightings. There's a link to that at the webpage, and you can see the photograph right there. Following the Sun UK's story of a UFO seen off Cornwall on December 29th, the offices were inundated by calls from people who had similar things all over the country. Some people claimed they had seen alien spacecraft off the same bay in Cornwall where the original UFO was snapped. A man who asked to be called just Edward took a strange-shaped object photo, which appeared to be buzzing a Navy ship. You can go take a look at that photo at coasttocoastam.com. He said, I was taking photos of the ship when a helicopter from it took off, flew west, then landed back on board just a few minutes later. It was only when I blew up the photos on my computer that I realized what the helicopter had gone off to take a look at. It was in the exact same bay as the one featured in the Sun article this week. Also, it says here, American holidaymaker, which always sounds like they're having more fun than just being a vacationer, doesn't it? American holidaymaker Ian Mulford also believes he snapped a UFO shot at virtually the same spot as Edward. Ian said, I was taking photographs and did not see anything unusual at the time, but after reviewing the pictures, I found something very unusual in the background of a picture of one of the family. And if his name is Ian, you know he can be trusted. A grandmother, Mary Booth, 57, says she saw what she believes was a UFO in Bristol on New Year's Eve. Mary was standing in her front garden with three other people when they noticed a bright orange ball-shaped object in the sky. She said, we live near Bristol Airport, so I often see planes and helicopters in the sky, and this was totally different. I was standing still in the sky, then it moved off our roof and then took off upwards, getting smaller and smaller. I have never believed in UFOs before, but after seeing that, I think there may be something to them. There was no way that this was an airplane or something like that. It was really, really weird, and we all saw it. Well, sometimes seeing is believing. And sometimes we can't see what is hidden in plain sight. And in the case of D.B. Cooper, that's plain, P-L-A-N-E, plain sight. Galen Cook joins us again after our conversation last Tuesday on Coast to Coast AM. And good evening, Galen.
Good evening to you, Ian. Good to be back on your radio show.
Well, good work on getting this photograph approved by the family that we talked about last Tuesday to be released for people who didn't catch the show because they might have been sleeping off something left over from New Year's Eve. Let's set the table again by talking about the chronology of what led up to this photograph.
You bet. First of all, I want to say that in this investigation business, you've got to be a little flexible. This photo, it blindsided me because I had a suspect previous to this that I'd been zeroing in on, and as a result of your show back near Thanksgiving time, I had a couple of emails that were interesting, one or two that I took great interest in and followed up on, and it resulted in a gentleman down in Utah who told me a story that his father had taken him downstairs, I guess he was about 20 years old at the time, and showed him his huge file on D.B. Cooper. And he said, I just want you to know that I was D.B. Cooper. Well, those kinds of stories are quite plentiful. The FBI's heard a lot of those. But I asked this gentleman if he had something more he could give to me to tie this thing in. And he said, I'll send you a photo and you let me know what you think. I got the photo, I opened it up in the mail, and I'm telling you, this is the best I've ever seen. I think we've all seen the photos of the three primary suspects the FBI has been looking at for the last 36 years, and none of them come close to this one. So I continued my discussion with this gentleman, and he's got two other brothers. I talked with one of the other brothers, and then I talked with the widow of the suspect, and at first they were all a little skeptical of me continuing this, but they all had been told by the suspect at one time that he was in fact D.B. Cooper, but it never went anywhere beyond that, Ian.
I know. Yep, we should establish the suspect, as you refer to him, we're not going to name him.
That is correct. One of the conditions the family wanted to set forth in order for me to use this photo and have it put up on Coast to Coast website was that they leave their name out of it right now because if, in fact, it turns out this is not D.B. Cooper, they don't want to go through a media circus, even if it's not.
Sure.
If it is D.B. Cooper, they probably will have to face the media at some point. But I told them that there'd be no problem. We'd protect their privacy interests,
right,
but by not putting the name out right now.
It's kind of hard to unring that bell once
we've done it. Yeah, it is. And I will say this about the family. They've been very polite to me. They're not looking for a payday on this or even any kind of name recognition. but the thing is, they do want the truth out there. And if this is, in fact, D.B. Cooper, they'd like to make sure that this gets in the hands of the FBI where it rightfully belongs later in the investigation.
Well, if it is D.B. Cooper, theoretically, they've already had their payday, right?
Yes.
I mean, the family. Now, and is there any story in the family that coincides with the sudden influx of cash?
Let me backtrack on that just for a minute.
Okay.
The widow, who I've been talking to, she's told me some very personal things that I'm not going to discuss on the radio, but she was not married to him at the time the D.B. Cooper thing unfolded back in 1971. So when you say the family has had their payday, that isn't true.
I see what you're saying. Okay, well, fair enough. Well, then, but they still may have benefited from him having that money if, in fact, that's what happened.
I kind of don't think so.
Really?
It gets kind of complicated, but this gentleman, or this suspect here, he was married four different times, and if you go to the Coast to Coast website, there's a little bit of information attached underneath the photo. And he was almost to a T, fits the description that the FBI has been using to locate him. 5'10", 175 pounds, dark eyes, dark hair, medium to well-built, athletic. And then it goes a little further than that. This suspect was a Green Beret. Actually, he served one tour towards the end of the Korean War and then three tours in Vietnam, and he was a paratrooper. So he had that experience. But what interested me the most was that his last station was in Fort Lewis, Washington, and that was back in 1971. And Fort Lewis is a major U.S. Army post located about 40 miles south of Seattle and about 20 miles or less south of SeaTac International Airport, directly on the flight path of Northwest Orient 305 back in 1971. And if you look at the sort of odd facts that are put together, one thing Cooper demanded before they took off that night on November 24th, 1971, was he wanted the rear stairs lowered before they took off. And the pilots declined that because it was unsafe for the plane to go through its takeoff procedures. But you have to wonder why he wanted that stairwell down before takeoff. And really, what he wanted to do was jump out of that plane quick. He wanted to be in territory he knew. And since it took a while to get that stairwell down once the plane was airborne, he ended up somewhere down in southern Washington, probably about 90 miles further south than he wanted to be, and that's where it became a risky jump at that time.
Right. All right. Well, let's we'll go over some of the chronology of that coming up in a minute, and we'll also throw open the phones again. Everybody, take a look at this at coasttocoastam.com. See the photograph. And then I refer you to, of course, to the police artist sketch of who it was, of who D.B. Cooper was supposed to be. What was interesting to me about the details of the website, Galen, was that he had a brother named Dan. Dan Cooper was the name that he actually gave to the ticket agent. Correct?
That is true, and there's a little something more to that. The flight counter that sold him the ticket in Portland International Airport, they interviewed the ticket agent when right after the hijacking, and of course they wanted a description of D.B. Cooper, and he said, well, he gave him a general description because he couldn't remember a whole lot about his physical appearance, but he did remember one thing about D.B. Cooper. He said when he asked him for his name, there was a slight hesitation before he gave him the name Dan Cooper.
So he may not have, he may have actually pulled that out of the air at the last second, or was just couldn't remember the phony name he was going to go by. Either way, that leads me right up to where I want to start with Galen Cook, attorney who used to be a private investigator who's been on the trail of the case of D.B. Cooper, who actually never called himself D.B. Cooper, as most people have been following the story knows. That was just a mistake that was picked up by the press. They ran with it as D.B. Cooper, and then later on the flight agent said, oh, no, wait, he said Dan Cooper. And but it's just one of those things that may be a serious clue, which we'll discuss next on Coast to Coast AM. Go look at that photograph at coasttocoastam.com. Only seems fair, since the story here that we're reporting tonight with the help of Galen Cook was broken by somebody who is listening to this show, that every time we talk about this topic, we ought to open the phone lines. We want you to go take a look at the photograph we put on the website tonight at coasttocoastam.com. Go see the photo of a likely suspect for D.B. Cooper. How likely? We haven't even gotten into the details yet. And wait till you hear, it's not just what he looks like, it's so much more than that. When you know his whole story and the story of D.B. Cooper, we'll put it together for you as you see the photograph at coasttocoastam.com next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so we're talking with Galen Cook, former investigator, now turned a lawyer. And in being a lawyer, he's been interested in D.B. Cooper. What is your, by the way, as a lawyer, is there any particular aspect of the D.B. Cooper investigation that intrigues you?
It's, you know, Ian, it's kind of like a mystery novel. In a mystery, when you read a good mystery, all the odd facts tie up at the end of the novel, and you're satisfied because the mystery's been solved. But in real life, it doesn't work like that. You've got these odd facts coming at you from every different direction, and you're trying to find a way to tie them up, and it's very difficult to do that. And I guess as an attorney, you're always looking for the facts to help solve or win a case. And
yeah, but you don't like have a dog in this fight, in the sense that you've got a case pending, or you want to make a legal case, or you want to sue somebody or anything. I mean, this is just, it's a curiosity, but you're not, you know, you're not trying to be Perry Mason here.
I'm not trying to advocate that this person is in fact D.B. Cooper. He's a good suspect, but we're trying to get to the truth of the matter and to find out if there's enough evidence here to support a further investigation. Now, as you, I'm sure you've been watching the news the last 3 days, the D.B. Cooper story has been all over the news. CBS, Fox TV has been interviewing investigators in New York City. It's virtually, and the paradox of this is that D.B. Cooper is everywhere in the news, but he's nowhere to be found. It's right. An unusual case. Right. One of the most famous unidentifiable persons in history. And thanks to the Internet and thanks to Coast AM, there's a chance this case could get solved. And if you don't mind, I actually have a request of your listeners.
Go ahead. Have at it.
Well, in order for this investigation to keep moving on, a picture is good because it shows the audience what this person might have looked like, and maybe he is D.B. Cooper, but we don't know that for sure. But one of the reasons I wanted this photo up on the web was because there were a plane load of witnesses who actually saw D.B. Cooper get on the plane on November 24th, 1971, and there's four witnesses in particular who got a good look at him. And I don't mind naming the names of these witnesses because they've been talked about in virtually every book that's been published about D.B. Cooper.
Okay.
And what I'm hoping is one of these witnesses will either be listening to the radio show and go to the website and take a look and see if this looks like the guy who was on the plane that night. Or maybe one of the friends of the witnesses will alert the witness, and then that person can go and take a look. Those witnesses are the three flight attendants, Tina Mucklow, Florence Schaffner, and Alice Hancock. Now, these ladies were all in their early and mid-20s back in 1971. And they probably don't have the same last names as they did back then. Florence Schaffner lives in the Lexington, South Carolina area, and she's actually been in contact with another investigator who's working the case out of New York City. But I'd like Florence, and if someone knows Florence, to have her get on the internet and take a look at this picture. Alice Hancock, I have no idea where she is, and Tina Mucklow, I don't think many people know where she is, but Tina was the flight attendant who spent the most time with D.B. Cooper on the plane. Now, the plane was hijacked around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and D.B. Cooper made his jump just a little after 8. So Tina had been on the airplane with Cooper for about 5 hours or so, and if she gets to take a look at this picture, she might help solve the case by recognizing. The last witness is a fellow named William Mitchell, who was also in his early 20s, and he happened to be seated across the aisle from D.B. Cooper. I think he was in seat 18A and Cooper was in 18E. And Mitchell was a college student returning home for Thanksgiving. And Cooper didn't mind if Mitchell sat where he was. And Mitchell certainly got a look at him. So there's four good witnesses in this case. And I'm hoping one or all of them will get a chance to look at this picture on your internet site, Ian.
Well, did he wear, there's so many things we got to get to before we get to the phone calls, but there are several people who are hanging on for you, Galen Cook.
Okay.
Did he wear his sunglasses the whole time?
This is the way I understand it. When he walked up to the counter to purchase the ticket, he did not put them on. He walked up and the reservation agent had a look at Cooper. As soon as he purchased his ticket, he went in an area by himself and put his sunglasses on. When he boarded the plane, he did not have his sunglasses. And when he passed the hijacking note to Florence Schaffner, he did not have his sunglasses on. But as soon as it was apparent that he was in command of the airplane, he put his sunglasses on and kept them on for a good part of the time. Now, most of the composites that the FBI has out there on the website, and I believe there's three or four of them, they all look pretty close. Some of them have them with the sunglasses, and some of them don't. So if you could imagine putting a pair of sunglasses on my suspect and holding the photo next to one of the composites or the artist's rendering, I'm telling you, it looks pretty good. It's,
yeah,
the hair is perfect. The hair is perfect. The eyes look, the eyes are unreal. Chin looks good. I'm telling you, this is the best photo I've ever seen.
All right. So, and we should, again, we're talking about a photograph that we've posted on the website at coasttocoastam.com from a listener who reached out to Galen Cook after his appearance on Thanksgiving. We talked about it on New Year's Day night, and the story's moving along pretty nicely. This was a guy who had told each member of his family that he was D.B. Cooper. He showed them a collection of photographs and what, sort of D.B. Cooper memorabilia?
Pretty much, yeah. He showed them, the fellow who contacted me on the email said he took them down to the basement and showed them a couple boxes of D.B. Cooper headlines from the newspaper and all the things that a person would collect about a story like that. And this was approximately 20 years ago, so this suspect at that time would have been in his early 60s already, or close to 60, let's put it that way. And there was something else that was interesting about it, too. He had talked about a briefcase that, and we don't know who has possession of that briefcase right now. It's none of the family members I've talked with, but they believe there's a briefcase out there because he did have a briefcase, and they thought they saw some money in it. Now, it's kind of speculative at that point, but apparently he did have a briefcase somewhere and kept it in a safety locker, and we're looking into that right now. So it's kind of sketchy, but we're still working on that. That's the angle of the story that needs to be developed.
Well, that would be interesting if there's any money anywhere that was being kept by him, and he didn't want to keep it in his house for fear that might lead to an investigation of him, so he kept it in a separate safe place, but someplace he might have access to. And maybe when he died, there was no chain of ownership for what was supposed to happened to that briefcase?
This suspect passed away a couple of years ago. He actually lived to about 77 or 78 years old. But aside from the briefcase, I did talk with the widow, and she said that he served in the military for quite a few years, about 23, I think, or 24. But when he wasn't in his military fatigues, he liked wearing suits. And she said that they went out often, and he did go for the less expensive type of suits and ties. And she did mention that he did like to wear a tie clip, too. And that was something else that struck my attention. Now, if you go to the FBI's website for the D.B. Cooper story, they've set out a series of photos of the tie clasp, the unused parachute, some of the money that was found. And, of course, the FBI is eliciting from the public information that might help solve the case. But really, the FBI's evidence hasn't changed for the last 30 years. It's the same stuff. And they want the public to come out and help them solve this case. So, really, that's what we're doing here, is providing new evidence, something they can hang their hat on.
And is there a reward being offered by the FBI?
Not that I know of, no. Over the years, there's been a few people who have come up with their own sort of reward. One of them was an author of a book, and he was going to, I think, produce $10,000 reward for anybody that could come up with a $20 bill that matched the exact serial numbers as a D.B. Cooper bill, but no one could ever do that. But as far as I know, the FBI has no reward base at all.
I tell you what we did, and thank you, Sean, for doing this. Our web surfer, Sean LaDecour, has put a side-by-side photo up now at coasttocoastam.com of the FBI composite without glasses right next to D.B. Cooper's photograph, as we understand it, from the family that contacted Galen Cook. Real quickly then, too, just to go back to his experience in the military, it would seem like he would be a perfect candidate for the unusual choices made around the parachutes. Again, we should stress that.
Yeah, there's no doubt that, in my mind, that D.B. Cooper had some parachute experience. You're not going to take someone who's never been in a parachute before and watch them jump out of the back of a 727 that's going 167 miles an hour. The FBI likes to believe that D.B. Cooper could not have survived this jump. You talk to most law enforcement people, and they tell you the same thing. There was no way he could have survived the jump that night, not just because of the forces that would knock you out when you fell out of the back of the plane, and also the cold dive going down to the ground, but also you're going to end up in the wilderness. Well, Flight 305 took a path, basically, that is very survivable. Parachute experts who made as many as 5,000 jumps have told me this is a very doable deal. The plane wasn't going 200 miles an hour when Cooper exited. It was going about 167. Cooper actually went on the interphone at one point and asked the crew to slow the plane down because he couldn't get the stairwell down. And they slowed it down to about 167, which was getting close to stall speed probably, but certainly when you go out the back of a 727, there's no obstructions. You just go right out the back, and any parachuter will tell you that's the ideal way to go.
Okay. So let's go ahead and get a parachuter. We've got Rob hanging on west of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM for Galen Cook. Rob? Rob, are you with us?
Yeah, Ian, I am with you.
You're talking to Galen Cook. Go ahead.
Hi, Galen.
Hi, Rob. How you doing?
Oh, great. I actually did a DC-9, and I will tell you, you're absolutely right. You do need experience to do a jump like that. And the velocity of 167 miles an hour is probably about right on. It is just before stall speed. But the thing that I know is that if you weren't experienced, you could definitely go into a tumble on a dive like this and not be able to get out of it. The person that would have had to have done it would have definitely needed to have military experience. But back in that day, one thing I would like to point out there is he was using a paracommander's parachute, which was not as steerable as the modern Ram Air ones, like the one that I use.
So your point?
Well, my point is that it is a risky jump. He's using a paracommander, right, and he's out at nighttime. He's right. not able to steer around the trees as the modern skydivers do with a Ram Air parachute.
Right. Oh, no. So there's no doubt it's a risky jump. I mean, but the fact is, and I will take your first point there, is very key, is that if you have enough experience and you know what to expect, that you would be able to avoid that. And that's a good point. Let me get to Todd in Louisiana on Coast to Coast AM, first time caller line for Galen Cook. Todd?
Hello, Galen.
Hi, you're talking to Galen. Go ahead.
Hi, Todd.
Hi, Ian. Hi, Galen. This is Todd, Bossier City with 40 and Threat Filmworks. The question and statement that I had to make was, if in fact this man does turn out to be the man, D.B. Cooper, what are the repercussions? I mean, the man is deceased, and what is it? What is the point of all this discussion? I mean, is it a baser instinct inside of us because he got one over on the man? Or, you know, what do you think it is that mystifies us about this subject?
Well, it's a good question you raise. A lot of people think this is one of the greatest legends in the Northwest, certainly, that a guy was able to beat the government and all the agents that were trying to track him down. But I think there's a little more to it. This was a fellow who did something no one else had ever done before, and he got away with it. And for whatever reason, we don't know the motive. I think what we have to know is who the person was. In my opinion, that is the whole mystery of it, was who is this guy 36 years later that we're still looking for? We don't even know who he is.
I think there's an element to this of a modern day Robin Hood, although there is no, you know, give to the poor aspect to this.
Yeah, I've heard that analogy used before, yeah. Ian.
And I think the fact that he innovated something is the other piece to this.
Well, he certainly started something, because there were a few copycat jumpers that tried it. One, Richard McCoy, he actually succeeded in doing it, and the FBI nabbed him the next day. But this, of course, started the airlines to go ahead and put what they called the Cooper vane on the back or the rear door of those stairwells, so that it could never happen again, and it never did happen again.
You know, I want to go back to the photographs that are on the website before we get some more phone calls. And there's something about the side-by-side photograph and the composite drawing from the FBI that keeps striking me, and that is the right ear. It is almost like the FBI sketch artist put a piece of paper over the photograph you have there of the unnamed man whose family has submitted this photograph for consideration, and drew around the ear. It is eerily close. The ears are just almost exactly the ears that are on the photograph.
It's perfect. Let me make another comment on that. The FBI has had three suspects that they've been zeroing in on over the years. Richard McCoy, who hijacked the United flight. He's deceased as of 1972. Another fellow was Dwayne Weber. The FBI ruled him out through DNA. And then the most recent one, a fellow named Kenny Christensen. And I'm looking at a picture of Kenny. I don't think he even comes close to looking like the composite. But CBS ran a special on D.B. Cooper two nights ago. And on that special, they indicated that all three of those suspects have now been eliminated. So what I did was I called up the investigator. He's a private investigator in New York. And I asked him if that was true. And he did tell me, yes, his suspect, who is Kenny Christensen, actually has been eliminated by the FBI. We don't know what the FBI did to eliminate him. But if that's true, it looks like this new guy that's up on your website, Ian, maybe someone the FBI better take a look at.
Well, I have every confidence that they are monitoring this broadcast tonight, as they I think they probably do every night. All right, I hope John and Jason can hang on. Here's what I want to do. I want to push off John J. Harper just a little bit and wrap up our conversation with Galen Cook after the top of the hour. You good, Galen?
That sounds good to me, Ian.
All right, we'll give a little bit more, and we'll put the story to bed for now until we get confirmation on this photograph at the website later on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.